It looks like it's just about 8:30. And I want to start on time so that we have all the time we can have. I'm trying to get through my presentation and leave time at the end, maybe for questions. I know we still have people streaming in, but I'm glad to see all of you here. This is a great opportunity for me because I am in the midst of a project attempting to compile and create and then write a global history of women in the Stone Candle Movement, which is a very daunting task. I've made a lot of progress on it, though, so I'm excited to share with you where I am with it right now. So sort of what you're seeing is my earliest draft on my thoughts on particular eras. So kind of each lectureship, I give a little piece of it. I am also the mother of three small children and many other things in life going on. So the book goes a little bit slowly, but it's going, and I'm really enjoying it. So today's task is to share with you what I'm thinking about right now in terms of the 1920s and 30s. And in particular, I kind of took off a somewhat smaller slice than I might in other classes I do at Bible lectures, because I'm looking at particularly the 20s and 30s, though not strictly, because of course things bleed over, but mainly, I'm also going to focus on the Churches of Christ as opposed to the whole movement for a variety of reasons. But as well, I'm also going to mainly focus on the United States for this particular one. And a few reasons for that as well that I'll share with you in a bit. Now, here are the goals for today, what I want to do. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the overall theme of my project. As I sat down and tried to organize this whole, what am I going to do with this global history? Where is this going to go? If I just tried to write out some kind of narrative telling everything, it'd be like 3,000 pages long. So instead, I found that there was a theme that jumped out at me that I kept coming back to. And so the book is increasingly focusing on that particular theme, which is female leadership in the Stone Campbell movement in general. What did that look like? How was it different from the way men led? And how did it contribute to the movement? So I'm going to look at it in the context of the Churches of Christ today, and I call it bridge leadership. I borrowed that concept. I'll tell you more about it in a bit. Then, what we're going to do, I'm going to give you a little bit of the historical context of the Churches of Christ in what you might also call the interwar era, if we're talking about 20s and 30s, in between World War I and World War II. I put in the United States there, and an asterisk, because normally I do like to talk very much more about a global context, but I'm just not quite there yet with the 20s and 30s, still piecing it together. Partly that's, in particular, if I'm going to look at the Churches of Christ, this is when they're really just solidifying an identity, is in this era, and it's not very international yet. And I wanted to talk about this one piece. I'll elaborate some of those reasons as we go along. Now, one of the things that is really interesting are the barriers to women's leadership in the Churches of Christ in the 20s and 30s. I'll tell you more about those in a little bit. And then I want to explore how this concept of female or bridge leadership affected three areas, mainly in journalism, missions and church support, missions being both domestic and foreign, and the support of churches in general, and education. Those will be the three main areas I'll look at. Now, to start with this concept of bridge leaders. I think I'll just put all this here. There. This is a concept I borrowed that has been really informative in helping me shape what I want to say about women in the Stone Campbell movement in general. I should give you a little bit of my background. I have been working now on Stone Campbell history, particularly women, for quite... It's been a long... Goodness, it's going on 20 years that I've been doing this. Started with my dissertation that I wrote in 1997 and 98, so yeah, it's been 20 years, which is amazing. And I wrote that on Selina Campbell, the second wife of Alexander Campbell. From there, I've done a whole variety of projects, but the main thing I want to focus on for you is what's different perhaps about me than some other historians you might hear is I'm not a church historian. And that may not mean anything to you guys, but to other historians, what it means is I'm actually a historian of women who just happens to study religion. So I come more from a women's studies background, a women's history background, but I developed this interest in women in the Churches of Christ. And the reason why I think God kind of called me to this, because there's some nice perspectives I can bring to understanding this kind of history. So that may help you understand where I'm coming from when I'm talking about some of these concepts. I'm applying what I've learned in women's studies and women's history to, hey, what's going on in churches of Christ? All right, that's when I give you the background for this about models for female leadership. As I told you, as I'm reading about women in the Stone Cowboy, it reminded me of this book I read years and years ago. I thought, oh, it's the same story. And this book was this one. Belinda Robnett's How Long, How Long? African-American Women in the Struggle for Civil Rights. And she argued that women in that movement were bridge leaders. She developed this concept of a bridge leader. What she said it was, is the way women functioned in the civil rights movement. A synonym could be a grassroots leader. And what she argued was they operated behind the scenes in kind of a private way, outside of structures or hierarchies. And that most of these bridge leaders, though not all, men can be bridge leaders too. This is an exclusive category, but most bridge leaders of this kind are women. Yet, here's the kicker. She basically argued they played a key role in building and sustaining the civil rights movement. And so the reason why that resonated with me is because I began to see, wow, you know, women are doing all kinds of things in the churches of Christ that would, I think, qualify in a certain sense as leadership. It just didn't look like the way men led. And so I wanted to delve into that, and it became a really nice organizing concept for the kinds of things women were doing. Let me elaborate on it a little more. So how is bridge leadership different from traditional leadership? I created this chart to give you a sense of what kinds of things I'm going to be talking about. So visibility is a key one. Bridge leaders operate in private, kind of behind the scenes. As I articulated, they're mostly female. Race is a key component here too, particularly within the Stone Cowboy movement, because both white and black women and men functioned as bridge leaders commonly. But your traditional leadership is mostly going to be white, whatever branch of the movement you're talking about. The relationship to institutions is key. These are unpaid, untitled people outside of institutions. They're influential. That's the thing that's key. They're still really influential, but just not in authority. Okay, whereas your traditional leadership is institutionalized. They're paid, they're elected, they're titled, they have clear authority. I gave examples of each. You hear your preacher's wives, ministry leaders, mothers, Sunday school teachers, church founders, all those things. Here, you know, I'm talking about preachers, elders. Those are the official titles, right? And yet, I would argue, you don't have a church without these people. You can have a preacher, but if you don't have all the other people to have going, it's not going to happen. And so I want to articulate how you can analyze this, what it is that women actually did. Okay, context. So this is the interwar period. And I would argue this is an era where there's a real emerging identity for Churches of Christ. It's just coming out. In fact, after I labeled it 20s and 30s, I was like, I don't know, you may have to start it more like around this era of 1906. You know, it may not fit the interwar exactly, but many of you know the hallmarks of this emerging identity, the a cappella worship style, the emphasis on male leadership. A lot of this in contrast to the part of the movement they're leaving behind, the disciples part. So they're making a contrast. The emphasis on congregational autonomy, you know, there's not to be any kind of denominational structure. And then here, too, the literal interpretation of Scripture in a certain sense. I mean, this is not my area of expertise, I'm not a theologian, but the influence of something called Scottish common sense realism, which basically just argues that all you need is common sense to read the Bible and anybody can understand it. And so you just take it, it says what it says, and it doesn't need to be any nuance there. That's part of the emerging identity of the Churches of Christ. But also, I want to add in some other things. There's some shifting demographics going on. People who identified with the Churches of Christ are shifting from a more rural, kind of lower or working class, agrarian group, southern, to a more urban, affluent, international presence. Just seeing that shift, which has a lot of implications for how the movement will transform to a certain extent. And look at this, that's accompanied with this tremendous growth. From 1960 to 1926, I looked up the statistics. The movement grows from, well, over 100%. 319,000 to over 682,000. And yet, what was really astounding is women made up 60 to 80% of church members. So I'm like, how in the world can we, you know, you read some of these traditional histories of the Church of Christ, there's not even a woman's name in it. I have students who help me research all the time for this project, and I'll tell them, okay, I'm going to give you this journal to go look at on microfilm. I want you to read through it. If you even see the name of a woman, write that down. Because then I'll have to go look them up and find out who they are, find out they have to play the key role. And so a lot of times the way we've written our history is not even recognize these powerful influences of the bridge leaders. And so I'm having to really tease that out through having a database of many thousands of sources to find a little snippet here and a snippet there to piece it together. Okay. Now, in this interwar era, you do have some common perceptions of women's role, particularly in the growth of this era, because that's the theme here, the growth, and that's the theme I honed in on. What role did women play in that? Was this just a men thing, the reason why the churches grew? Or what role did women play? And I thought this was a great image for how the traditional view, right? Oh, the umbrellas, I loved it. You almost see a hierarchy, right, there implied. And I'm not saying this is wrong or incorrect, but it leads to a certain impression about what women were doing in the churches, that they were silent, uninvolved, that they're passive, that they're mainly just the pew warmers. Right? We would get that impression. Now, all of us kind of know that's not true, right? We know it. It's funny how what we read in a history book, we kind of fundamentally know in our hearts is not true. But yet, no one has articulated the details of how this is not true. That's what I'm going to try to do. Okay, then, and one last little piece to put together, and then I'll look at some of the specifics. What were the barriers to women's leadership? I started with this. I ran across this on Google one time. I'm like, oh, it's so true. This was an example of Church of Christ theology on women's roles. And then this whole part here. Today it's becoming clear there are two Churches of Christ. Mm. This view of women's role. I do not permit a woman, teacher, have authority over man, but to be in silence. This one. Following the demands of the feminist movement. Apparently those are our two choices. Right? Have women preachers, women appointed elder deacons, women's teach mixed adult class. Does that sound familiar? Right? That's an example of the theology. So, I mean, if that's your theology, that, first of all, that only officially named teachers matter, there's an issue there. You're not going to see women at all if you think that's all that matters. Women become absolutely invisible if that's all that matters. I'm not here to argue which one is correct at all. I'm not a theologian. That's a whole other debate. But I want to talk about what it has for our perceptions of history and what it actually misses about what women actually do. What are these barriers? Now, another way of looking at the barriers, and that's sort of the theological, but what does it come down to? Well, one problem for women in the Churches of Christ, this dawned on me after a while, there's no parachurch organizations that, by the way, are very typical of almost any other religious tradition. Everything from missionary societies, these were incredibly powerful women. Raised millions of dollars, sent female missionaries overseas. There was a whole empire for women in that, but not for Church of Christ women. Although there are some exceptions to that. We'll talk about it in a little bit. They had ladies' aid societies and little groups of women that would raise money. You'd see these occasionally in Churches of Christ, but they were generally excoriated by the male leadership. This should not be happening. And what those organizations did, you get a group of women together to plan things, raise money, you know, do things, and that really empowered them. But if your theology argues if you can't do that, then for women, that was a major barrier. They couldn't unite in any way as women. They were just kind of subsumed into the church membership. Then, of course, the literal interpretation of Scripture. If you take it to its extreme, I read plenty of people that said, why do women even come to church? Because they can't say anything. They just wait till their husbands get home. They'll tell them what, happened. I mean, that's the most important thing. Which, if you took Scripture literally, without any kind of
context
or using common sense or anything else, that's where you get. There were those voices. Then Southern culture is part of it as well, which tended to be more resistant to change. There's also this heritage of chivalry, sort of, like women particularly kind of almost put on the pedestal, but really expected to just be the genteel Southern woman and not get their hands dirty doing a variety of things. That too tended to limit women's roles. Then, of course, there's ideas about race, because I want to say a lot about black women today, because the 20s and 30s are really where they emerge, even more so than white women, in some really fascinating ways. But race was another factor that's influencing how you see the roles of women in some very interesting ways. Okay, moving on. I don't want to run out of time. Okay, so a few areas we can see this. Let me show you some of the ways if you start looking where you can see where women were leading in very significant ways. One of those is domestic missions. That's what I termed it. This is an area of female leadership really difficult to document. Churches of Christ are really only recently writing histories. One of my best sources, I've unearthed as many as possible, congregational histories. Those have proved to be the best way to find out, hey, what was actually happening in churches? And from reading now, I guess I'm up to a couple hundred of those, and there's many more to go. I keep unearthing them, and I get as many as possible because it helps me to get a sense of what's going on. Here's what I learned from my, albeit somewhat anecdotal, research. I'm guessing as many as a third or more of all churches were founded by women. Where a group of women start meeting in their home, once they get enough of them together, they would write to the Gospel Advocate or to the Firm Foundation, one of these other journals published by Churches of Christ, and saying, we need a preacher. And then, you know, after a while, one would come, and they'd raise the money, or they'd raise the money for the building and get the preacher. This is how it worked very often. And to tell you the truth, people so often ignored that part because it's really about the preacher, right? Yeah. So if you only look at the preacher, you don't even see the women. So it's hard for me to even find out how often this happens because people just don't care to document it. But think of what that meant. Do you have that church with that preacher, without this group of women that got together? And look at what they represented. There's one out of the Beacon Hill Congregation of San Antonio. The very first church ever in Houston, Texas, was a group of women who rented a hall and began that church. This is true of black women as well. The first black Church of Christ in New Orleans that met on LaSalle Street, met in the home of this woman, Ella Dixon. Annie Tuggle, many of you may be familiar with her name. If you're not, you should be. She's amazing. Organized a church in her home in Tennessee for black women. And I threw this kind of in here, so I won't ignore it. She also often was one of the few educated people in church service, and the preachers who were preaching themselves often couldn't read or write, and they'd call on her to read the scripture, because she was one that could. She was an educator. I'll talk more about her in a little bit. So, now I did want to note here, one of their first tasks was to find male leadership. But it was women that sustained this. They were the ones doing it on these new churches, really often. I can't quantify it. I don't know if I'll ever be able to, because I don't know that the records are there to really indicate, but I get a sense this happened a lot. Now, foreign missions. This is an area that's really important. This may be almost one of the most important things to say about this era, the 20s and 30s. This is the first time the Church of Christ really start to become an international presence. And women played a key role in that. They were among the most successful missionaries. So here they're playing this really significant role in internationalizing the Churches of Christ. One of the first areas this happens, there's many, and I could have talked about all of it, but I knew I only had, want to keep it to about 30 minutes so that we can have time for questions. One key place, Japan. One key figure there, Sarah Andrews. She starts working with McCaleb. J.M. Thank you. I was going to say that, and all of a sudden it sounded wrong. J.M. McCaleb. He had gotten there a few years earlier, but she gets inspired, wants to go into the mission field. I can tell you so much more about her story, but I won't get lost in the weeds here. She shows up, but within a year, she thinks she's ready to go on her own. This is a single woman, by the way. The vast majority of women who were successful in the mission field were single. In fact, for a lot of women in the Church of Christ, marriage was like the kiss of death for doing anything. because then you got kids, you got a husband to take care of, forget it, it's over. So most of them are single. And she's one of those. She arrives in Japan, she works with Michaela for about a year, and then decides to basically strike out on her own. She does all her own investigation. She visits a lot of cities. She corresponds with the government in those cities. And eventually picks this one, Okitsu. There, opens her new ministry there in the early 1920s. She's the only missionary in that city. I think it's one of the reasons she picked it. Here's a place that needs someone. Here was her method. She would open a kindergarten. This was the most success Church of Christ ever had. Open a kindergarten for kids, kind of like preschool, daycare kind of thing. Offer education to all children. Then, once you start meeting their mothers, you work on the mothers, basically. I mean, I'm kind of shortcutting a little bit. There's a lot more nuance to it than that. But then they offer programs for mothers. Convert the women. Then you start working on the fathers. Well, once her ministry got up and going, she was averaging a convert a month. Which, let me tell you, for Japan in this era, is really significant. Then she would call in one of the local Japanese preachers to come in and baptize them. So it was somebody that would come every so often to do the baptisms. What's really interesting about that, but Caleb never had much faith in local Japanese leadership. Andrews did. In fact, women were much more likely to work with indigenous leadership than men were. So, eventually the city actually provided her with a property rent-free for her school. She was beloved in the community. The story takes a really dramatic turn that I can't emphasize too much right now, but you should go look her up. There's several things that have been written about her. She actually stays when the war starts because of her heart for all the people that she had worked with. She remains. She doesn't leave. Now you can imagine the government doesn't treat her too kindly at that point, particularly the national government. Locally, it wasn't as big a deal with the national government. And so they refuse to let anyone feed her. She almost starves. It's a very dramatic story of how she survives the war, which she does. But barely, her health was more or less ruined by it. But she was so beloved. There's monuments to her in the community and all that. I mean, really fascinating story. She's one, by the way, of dozens of women that did this in our movement. Anyway, I could tell you a whole lot more about her. But this was, to the extent the Church of Christ had any success, a lot of it was what women did, you know, in Japan. Not all, but a lot. And this was a role that these single women seized for themselves. It was kind of like an opening they saw. Because it's not like the preachers came back and said, okay, all you single women, you know, go with me back to Japan. No! In fact, it was sometimes difficult for them to convince people in their lives, I should do this. You know, this is a good idea. So they had to overcome a lot of perceptions. It's not safe for a woman to travel by herself. In fact, they had to travel with someone. And I mean, there are all kinds of barriers to this. But she and many other women overcame them and served really admirably in the mission field. All right, now I have sort of a vague category I call church support. All kinds of things subsumed in this, really. But I thought it worth pointing out that the vast majority of church secretaries were women. This doesn't surprise anyone, right? Mm-hmm. But really, is this some unimportant role?
Yeah. No, maybe
not. Yeah. Who really knew what was going on in church? Who really coordinated ministry in church? It would be the secretaries, who were almost exclusively women, in this era in particular.
Yeah.
So I would argue they're part of the pivotal support structure for the congregation. Now, I'm just learning how this sort of functioned in Black Churches of Christ. This is where, you know, I'm wanting to learn more. But I thought a related role that I do know about was in among Black Churches of Christ, the Christian Echo was the key publication. And if you read that publication, there's every issue has reports from churches. And I would venture to say the majority are written by women. So I don't know if these were the church secretaries. I haven't looked into it yet about whether the one who corresponds with the Christian Echo to say what's going on in our church, you know, who's been preaching here lately, who's gotten married, who's gotten baptized, how many converts we've had, all of that. But it was a woman that was making the report, which to me argues it might be something like a church secretary or the equivalent. And so the majority, I would argue, were doing this. In a related sense, the actual, like, publicity for the church, the organization of the church, that's women, for Black churches and white churches. They also were often the chief fundraisers. In Black Churches of Christ, this takes on the form of something that's often been called racial uplift. Here's the idea. You got Black preachers, you want to make sure they put on a good image, right? Because you already got, you know, it's Jim Crow era. You've already got threats of violence, you know, rampant segregation, one of the most violent eras in American history. And if you are among the Black churches, you at least want to put on a good front, like, you know, we are respectable, we are worthy of inclusion. And women took on key roles in that, because one of the things, you don't want your preacher traveling around in rags, right? That would only reinforce some really negative stereotypes. So it was often women that would take on the role of raising the money to support the preachers. New clothing, better housing, travel expenses. Now, I should say, I don't mean to in any way neglect the fact that the main goal here was, you know, reaching lost souls, for sure. But there are other implications to what was happening as well. Then, in most congregations, it's women who actually raise money to support the purchase of needed church items, whether it be linens, curtains for the windows, or some even pivotal things, a baptistry, or communion ware. And particularly during the Depression, when money is tight, you know what these women did? They would bake dinners and go downtown and sell them to people walking down the street, take that money, and then use it for the church. What's really ironic about that is if you had been in a disciples' church, they would have just held, like, something at the church. And then it'd be a lot easier. This is how Church of Christ women had to be really creative to make it work. But they did, despite all those barriers. And during the Depression, in disciples' churches, I'll throw this in here. And I haven't seen it as much in Church of Christ. It doesn't mean it didn't happen, because sometimes in Church of Christ, just not as well documented. But I know in disciples' churches, it's really well documented in their church histories. Women raised all the money to build new buildings. It was often the women who said, we want a new building. Raise the money, give it to the church, and then get the new building. Interesting stories about that. And then this one blew me away. I kept running across this. I'm reading all these church histories. In the Northern Church of Christ, those of you who know much about Church of Christ history, these would be the Psalmer churches. The song leaders were very commonly women. I don't know exactly why it was that.
Men couldn't start a tune off right, and their wife maybe have to.
Used to sit up front.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. They did it while they were seated. They'd sit up in front. The women would be sitting there in the front row, start singing.
That was in Canada too.
Is it in Canada?
It was common in Canada, not in Summer churches.
Okay, so everybody, see, these are things I'm just learning about. How, you know, where does this go? I just happened to run across it, reading all these histories of Summer churches, and it was a constant theme. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. Now, apparently by the 40s, they finally could stand in front some, which is interesting. Another little interesting story about, you know, what...
The disciples or the churches?
The Northern Churches of Christ.
Northern.
Yeah, in some. I think it was not as common, but there were some women who did. And it was not unusual for a preacher who kind of travels around holding the, you know, revivals to have a daughter, sister, wife who would do this, lead the singing, which is true of all faith traditions, but in Churches of Christ as well. Okay, journalism is another key area. You can't really overestimate the role of journalism in the history of the Churches of Christ, because if you don't have a denominational structure, you don't have a headquarters, you don't have all that, how do you communicate? How do you have a movement? A lot of it was through the journals, where people would debate the issues. And you might think, oh, well, you know, that's probably a man thing. And it was in a way, but in another way, you know, women here too had a voice that really emerged in the 20s. One of my favorite stories, I learned about this. The Psalmers, Kate and Daniel, who published one of the most important journals for the Northern Churches of Christ. Daniel started traveling around preaching, so he left the journal in charge of his wife, and eventually he started getting kind of radical and sort of annoying a few people, so she took over, and the preachers started writing to her about, we like what you're doing better, so she took over and, like, throws out her husband. He was mad about that. They argued about it. I have their personal correspondence where they argued about it. So one of the most influential journals in the whole history of the Churches of Christ for a couple decades was edited by a woman who controlled the content and the debate over the issues. But that's kind of before the time here, but I had to throw that in there. It'll be in the book, so wait for that when that comes out. Now, in terms of the 20s and 30s, key figure here is this woman, Winifred Mason Moore Showalter. And early in her life, she ran a business so that her husband, who at the time was Marshall S. Mason, could travel and preach. Get this, he can't make this up. While he's preaching, he's actually shot and killed. Not while he was preaching, but on a preaching tour by someone who had some grievance against preachers. He's murdered. Wow, that's an interesting story. Well, after her husband's murder, now she's having, you know, she's kind of regrouping a little bit. I will point out, though, she ran their family business so he could travel and preach. That was actually really common. Preachers were encouraged to marry wealthy women so that they could have support to travel. I have it documented. And in fact, that's one of the things in the earlier part of of the book is in the part I'm developing now, is that if a woman did not provide critical support to a husband's preaching career, his preaching career died. She had to be the one to support it. Because at this point, you still don't have a really well-developed paid ministry. It's coming. In some places, urban areas, yes. Rural areas, no. So you have these traveling preachers, almost like a circuit, pretty close. Okay, so she's running the business so that her husband can travel and preach. Okay, he's murdered. You know, she has to change up her plans a little bit. So she gets an offer from the publisher of The Christian Worker in 1931 to start writing a column, and that becomes part of her support. Well, she actually eventually marries the editor of that journal, Homer Moore, and... Oh, perfect. Let me see if I can at least get rid of that. Okay. Oh, maybe not. Well, it should bother us. Okay. I'll try to get rid of that in a second after this slide. She marries this man. Well, he then encourages her to create actually a whole magazine for women in 1933 called Christian Woman, still in publication. And it was really the first publication for women in the Churches of Christ. This is the first one. And here's the founding statement. It's kind of interesting. You know, it's our purpose, Lord willing, to publish a monthly magazine consisting of 16 pages. So Scripture made 50 cents a year. We will have all women writers. Isn't that interesting? That actually wasn't typical, by the way. You could have a women's journal, but yet have it be mostly male writers writing to a female audience. But this would be all women writers. Women who are trained and educated both in college and the best of all schools, the School of Experience. We pray that this magazine will be a means of working to an end for self-development along the four fundamental lines: spiritual growth, moral stability, social development, and physical culture. Published all kinds of women you probably know about. Helen Young, Della Pack, Mrs. Carl Spain, many others. And I would argue this is the growing public voice of women in the Church of Christ. Even a denomination never intended for that to happen. It sort of happens anyway. And the Christian Woman was a part of that. But I could show you all over the place. I decided not to for brevity today, but all over the place women are publishing in other journals as well, in all kinds of ways. And so I've certainly heard their voice everywhere. Another one, Christian education. This was another field of significance. In fact, one where one might even argue Churches of Christ distinguish themselves. On a per capita basis, the Stone Camel movement in general has more Christian colleges than practically any faith tradition in the country. This was a major emphasis. In fact, just for fun, I'll tell you that one of the first things it does in the very first chapter of this book I'm working on is that none, and I mean none, of the first generation of preachers in the Stone Campbell movement did not at some point teach women as their sole means of support, or at some point in their career teach women. That was like a growing industry at the time to have a school for women, because you already had school for men. It's kind of like the growth industry of the era. And that's how they'd make their money. Although the irony is they would then go off traveling to preach and leave their wife, daughter, or female associate in charge of the school. But that's a little variation. Who would actually do all the work. But you had to have that male name on it to give it the legitimacy. Okay, so one of the things Churches of Christ did too, they inaugurated something called Bible Chairs, which is essentially where they would find a preacher to work at a public institution, you know, university, who would offer religion courses to students attending that university, Church of Christ students. One of the first was at the University of Texas. Later, that Bible chair would actually evolve into the Austin Graduate School of Theology that exists today. But women were the chief energy behind the fundraising. You can look this up in the journals. You look, okay, here's a list of contributors to the, you know, Austin Bible chair. 3/4 women, for sure. And they raised the money for this. This is kind of a women's project, these Bible chairs. And it fit with women's role in education. There was this idea that women were natural educators. After all, isn't that what we kind of see mothers as, you know, training children? Mm-hmm. I mean, fathers too, to a certain extent. I'm not saying fathers don't do it too, but we have the sense of mothers being central teachers of children. They also played a role in educating preachers. To the extent that black preachers were trained, it was black women that staffed the schools. Black women were much more likely to be educated than black men, and so they played a key role in that process. Some of the schools, in fact, that associated with the Churches of Christ that would admit black students, because few would, and so it's mostly all black schools, they were staffed almost entirely by women. And then I this blew me away. Mm-hmm. Minnie Keeble, Marshall Keeble's first wife, was the one that taught him to read and write.
Yeah.
Played Sheen.
Not good.
Yeah, right. But I also want to mention Sunday school teachers. You know, look at this. Most preachers heard the gospel first from a woman. Yeah. Probably, you know, most of us, because either their mother or a Sunday school teacher. There's plenty. If you read a memoir about a preacher, just look. Almost always, the first person that they credit with teaching them the gospel, the Bible, is a woman, one way or the other. And that's bridge leadership, right? They don't have a title, really. I mean, Sunday school teacher, close as it gets. But yet, they're the ones that are training up the next generation of preachers to a certain extent.
Just a brief note here. This bridge, you call it, is a concept that's in MBA programs. That's called informal leadership.
Right, exactly.
And we study that, mm-hmm. and it always happens.
Mm-hmm.
And it forms the culture of a company. And you have to be aware that it's always going to happen.
Yeah, so I mainly just want to document how it played out in Church of Christ.
Exactly.
That's really all I'm doing. Okay. I wanted to mention in particular Annie Tuggle, one of the most inspirational figures in the history of the Stone Campbell movement. Her story is fascinating. Almost her entire life was a struggle to find an education that she felt did not undermine her faith. No schools in Church of Christ would accept black students in the beginning. So she was actually a 17-year-old seventh grader, finishes high school at 30, and is a college freshman at 34. She did eventually attend the Silver Point Institute in Tennessee, one of the most important of schools for black students. This was one of my G.P. Bowser key figure, Black Churches of Christ. But terrible school conditions. There's no running water. They had to burn wood for the heat, so it's super smoky in there. And this is like, really desperate situation, broken windows. It actually closes after only 4 years. Part of the reason was the way most white schools made it is they had land to grow food on. The students would help with that and sell the crops, make money for the school. This is how it worked, in the early 20th century, particularly in the South. But they didn't have the access to that, so therefore not the funding that you would need to make the school successful. Well, eventually she would start serving as a field agent to raise funds for the school. So this is a woman, practically the only woman to ever do this among Black Churches of Christ, traveled around to churches, individuals, raising money for the school. She convinces Dave Lipscomb to support it, and he recruits some other folks too. She and her mother actually planned to leave. They had a family farm. They were fortunate to have it. They were going to leave it to the school, and they're devastated when it closes. She's part of another school, this one, the Southern Practical Institute, which opens in 1920. She's going to be a teacher there. One key vineyard lecturer, Christ R. N. Hogan, was her student. Bowser would be the principal. Closes after 6 weeks because the white benefactors insisted all the black students enter through the back door. And Bowser says, no. Many people actually argued, look, education is more important than your dignity. He said, no, it's not. And it was only open 6 weeks as a result. Later, Bowser would go on to have several other schools. Tuggle was a constant support to those schools. She wrote her autobiography, a fascinating story that's one of our best sources on the history of Black Churches of Christ, especially from a woman's perspective. That covers the main outlines of what I would argue are women as bridge leaders, how critical it was to the development of the movement on many levels. But I want to leave the rest of the time for questions. We have several minutes left to do that.
I'm interested in your expertise on Selina Campbell. You mentioned that all the first generation of male leaders at some point taught women or ran schools for women. And you said it was important to have a man's name. But didn't she run a female seminary? Was that under her own name, or was it...
You're probably thinking of his sister. Yeah.
Oh, Jane. It's his sister.
Yes.
Oh, Jane. Okay.
Yes.
So talk about Jane then and her school.
Oh, yeah,
was it under her own name?
Well, the early... Yeah, oh, yeah. Okay. Yes. In her case, a little bit different. Partly because it's almost a... second generation, but partly because she was also a sister of this well-known man, and partly because she was amazing.
Yeah.
Great teacher. Apparently a fundamentally better teacher than Alexander Campbell ever was. And Thomas Campbell, too.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a lot of evidence that she was the one that ran Campbell's Buffalo Institute while he went around preaching. It's not super clear, but there's some evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And then she and Thomas Campbell ran a school together in Kentucky. And then he tried to teach a group of black students, and the local community came and said, you can't do that. And so he said, I don't want to have anything to do with this place. And then left. And she begged to stay and run the school, you know, let him leave. And he wouldn't let her. But all indications are that she was the best teacher of the Campbells. but she eventually opens this school just over the border in Pennsylvania from where they were in West Virginia. Basically, the reason her school worked, it had been a co-ed school till he opens Bethany College and then kind of siphoned off all the male students. And so hers became the female. And that was a model that actually happened a lot. Whenever there was a school formed for teaching preachers in the Stone Campbell movement, there'd be a women's school right next to it to provide education for women. Up until about maybe like Lipscomb, which was co-ed. Then Campbell, Jane Campbell's school burns, and then so they integrate Bethany College in the 1870s. It did happen at that point. But I hope that answers your question at least a little.
Yeah, the story needs to be told. So yeah. Thanks for working on it.
Yeah, sure.
This isn't really a question. It's more just a comment going on with your gathering history from churches. I've come from Beams of Ontario in Canada, and in a recent sermon, Don Smith mentioned that he went through some of the historical notes that his gentleman was taking every week in the 1920s. And a lot of people may or may not know, but our church now has women leading singing and reading scriptures. I'm part of it, and I'm so pleased and so thankful to have that opportunity. But in the 1920s, they came across this, journal from the 1920s saying that Sister Jones led singing this Sunday morning, and it was just matter of fact, this is mm-hmm. what she did. And it was so lovely and so reaffirming because our church had spent over 20 years studying this and trying to move it forward. And yet we were already kind of forward in the 1920s.
That's part of my goal. Is I think a lot of us don't know that stuff actually happened 100 years ago, you know, that we think is brand new now. No, it happened. We tend to think of history as linear, that you start out with women get to do nothing, and now they get to do a ton, and it's really more like up and down, depending on
that stuff to you as well.
Yes.
And I sort of want to piggyback on that because, I've read about Tuggle and others, but I'm interested because that's true in other traditions as well, black women reading, mm-hmm. right? But for Anna C. Tuggle to be reading at gospel meetings and reading scripture in church, it's quite interesting. So just regardless of race, when do you see, you talk about up and down in terms of African American and white women participating in the church, when does it begin to trail off? You talked about the 20s and 30s, when does it start to trail off where, they're not going to be reading or singing, sitting down or otherwise? When does that start?
I haven't teased this all out because it's sort of like I'm going chronologically and I'm sort of in the 20s and 30s right now, but I have a general overview I've gotten. My sense is about the 50s.
Yep.
Or even 40s.
I'd say 50s.
Yeah, because you have in general in American culture, although it's kind of ironic because I don't want to claim too much for that. Yes, you have a certain retrenchment, a certain rhetoric that argues for a lesser role for women, but it was by no means universal. I try to teach my students this. You got a nuance here. Yes, there's a tremendous message out there that says women should not be doing A, B, and C. And yet, same era. You've got Helen Young doing all kinds of amazing things. There's exceptions that are incredibly important. But yes, there's a bit of a retrenchment. It's kind of a Cold War thing, right? Because, the idea is we got to protect American institutions or we're going to get overrun by the communists. And what do the communists do? They try to tell you men and women are the same, and they try to tell you religion doesn't exist. We got to protect those things, you know. And so there's a bit of a rhetoric out there that does tend to limit changes in women's role because that's seen as too dangerous to our stability as a society. So that's definitely there. But it's not exclusive. There's people that fight back against it successfully. And then you're next, I thought.
Have you looked at the role that external culture plays on the church? Because that's one thing, once I started looking at the broader culture, there's a whole context outside of our little mindset that influences. And as societal things change, the way we view things change too. As much as we like to think that we're not influenced by that, we are. And here in North America, we have a whole different understanding of how things work than other countries in the world do. And so, you know, and so to me, I always think, because I'm not American, I always think, okay, so how do you deal with global history when Americans have a certain mindset, other places in the world have a different mindset, and so how do you then work?
Yeah, of course, this presentation doesn't deal with that nearly as well as I sometimes do, partly because I didn't want to pack in too many countries in one, but... one of the things I try to do is sort of walk people through how culture influences without, because I think people get afraid of that.
Yeah.
Like somehow, oh, the church has sold out or something.
Yeah.
And as a historian, I can see it. Because, you know, this has not been the thing the Church of Christ has been good at. Their whole idea, you know, I show you might have seen one image there that said Church of Christ founded AD 33 or whatever. It's like, well, yes and no. I mean, I understand what you're trying to say, that nothing in between matters. And yet it does. we are shaped by all kinds of thinking. But a lot of people feel very threatened by that, though, and I try to be sensitive to that. That this idea that church just bends and sways with culture, I don't think that. The church is interacting with culture, which is, I think, what God called us to do, you know, to a certain extent. But it is true. You can't deny. Now, some will say, well, that's just bad. We have to try to, you know, like, become deliberately oppositional.
Crystallized.
And I think, well, you know, how's that going to work? You know, what battles are you then taking on? Anyway, we could talk about that for a long time. But I do take that very seriously, as a historian in particular, because that's what I'm looking for. What shapes this? Now, I always leave room. Here's where it's difficult to task the historian, because on the one hand, you don't want to say that the church is only a product of culture. I don't believe that. You know, God's working through it regardless. So there's a balance. I try to find a balance. Yeah.
You mentioned a lot of similarities, the bridge leaders in the white and black communities. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the contrast, how these women lived out their bridge leadership in different ways in those two communities.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm thinking the United States.
Yeah, well, one of the differences is that the more access that black women had to education than black men on average led to, you know, a lot of women playing unique roles, like Annie Tuttle, who's, you know, the woman reading in the service when that would usually never happen. And so I think that's one way. And this is some I'm still documenting, some of the changes. You know, it's incredibly a lot more challenging to document the experience of women in black churches of Christ, because to the extent I don't even have records for white churches of Christ, for black churches of Christ, it's even more complicated. But I'm finding them little by little. I find little pieces. As I said, I search through publications, look for a name, and then start Googling that name, and then find out, oh, look at what they did. And then sometimes I even find a newspaper article that has their obituary and find out, oh, they did A, B, and C. And I'm like, oh, look at that. And I have a whole database of several thousand sources like that where I'm trying to piece together how much can I say, how many, if I get these women's stories together, how much can I say this was typical or not, or, yeah.
You mentioned the church being influenced by culture. I've tried to understand this in context of three different big events that happened in our church history, and I think all three were brought about by our having to relook at some things that we had already decided because culture was forcing us to look at it again. And one of those was slavery,
mm-hmm.
and the second one that I see was the civil rights going on in the 60s. And the third one I see is this, the women's issue, as we call it.
And wait till you see what I have to say about the 60s, little teaser. Women, in the 70s in particular, women in the Churches of Christ were almost single-handedly responsible for the defeat of the ERA. You can write some of it in the 70s.
That's true.
Okay. Oh, you'll hear more about that later. I was surprised by that when I found out. More than any other tradition. Like, a lot of people know Phyllis Schlafly.
Mm-hmm.
Her second-in-command was a Church of Christ woman. And
then,
anyway, that's all. It's a whole other thing you don't worry about.
To build on your bridge leaders, Hawthorne, California, 1947, where I started as a little boy, Randy Long was the Sunday school teacher. Kind of right away, and she did his only. But that church grew to about 400 in the 60s. But if you grew up in that church, every child had Randy Long. For a teacher,
mm-hmm.
and the elders, if Granny Long didn't like it, it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And if Granny Long loved it,
that's one thing
it's
I almost
happen.
Talked about. I read an article called She Elders,
yeah.
in this era, the 20s and 30s, which said it was these elders who were controlled by women.
Yeah.
and that this was detrimental to the church, and we need to fight against this. I almost put it in here, too, because I said, see, there's this informal leadership. These men were afraid, wait, there's too many women influencing the elders. Oh, and they said, the implication was very misogynistic. It's like, these women don't know what they're doing, you know,
But every husband knows that. Mama ain't happy. No, Right. Well,
I think we're out of time. I think I want to let the room be available to the next class. But
can we get a copy of that?
Yes, if you send me an email, I'd be happy to share it with you. Feel free to pester me by email. I'm a busy mom. I'll tell you, it's L Long. That's my maiden name. So LLong@pepperdine.edu. Okay. Feel free. I'd be happy to send it to you.
Are you
teach here? I do, yes, I do teach here. Yes.